The Upright Citizens Brigade began as a sort of a theater company of comedians and actors and artists on the streets and the small theaters of Chicago, moved to New York City, became known as a theater, as a home for comedy training, had a series on Comedy Central. Matt Walsh, you were there at the very beginning, one of the founders of the UCB. So tell me, has reinventing comedy taken about as long as you thought it would?
Well, I believe Clinton was president at the time, and we were watching the OJ verdict being released.
So it was a dark time in America.
It was a seminal moment of changing comedy.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast number 210, Upright Citizens Brigade. Chances are you've seen Matt Walsh in many of his hysterical small roles in movies like The Hangover, Elf, Old School, Bad Santa. But he's also one of the founding members of the Upright Citizens Brigade, a comedy group and comedy school that's training a new generation of comic actors. Matt and I sat down last week, you know, sort of comedy legend to comedy legend, and he schooled me on the history of UCB.
Yeah, we started doing sketches in, like, the early 90s, me, Besser, Ian, and then...
Matt Besser,
Ian Roberts, mm-hmm. And then, for those of you in England who don't know us, of course, everyone in America is very familiar. And then in, like, 94, Amy came around, and in between...
Poehler.
Thank you, Amy Poehler. They know Amy.
Yeah, everybody knows Amy
but
Poehler.
It could be Amy Sedaris. What's another
could
famous
be.
Amy?
Yeah.
Who's Steven Spielberg's wife, or former wife?
Amy Irving.
Amy, it could be Amy Irving, but it's not.
When did you start doing comedy with Amy Irving?
And then we, 94, Amy Poehler started doing it full time. And then in 96, we moved to New York to try to get a TV show.
Right.
The four of us,
yeah.
And, you know, literally in a van full of props and all of our wigs.
Really? Really?
Yeah, truthfully, yeah. Because we'd been doing shows around Chicago at places like... Kill the Poets and Improv Olympic and Cafe Voltaire.
Right.
And it was always very, like, not avant-garde, but, like, very, like, in your face, like, doing fake virtual reality and audience interaction and...
Well, and not just audience interaction. I mean, Reduced Shakespeare Company fans know how we abuse the audience.
Yeah.
Like, latecomers, breaking the fourth wall, that
yes.
kind of thing. But you didn't break the fourth wall. You guys left the theater. You
yeah.
guys took the show out onto literally the streets
yeah.
and sometimes the buildings across the street.
Yeah. Yeah.
Am I remembering correct? Was it Raj? Horatio
yeah.
Sands did a bit where he was literally on the roof of the building across the street?
Yeah, and Raj actually got arrested. They were doing a fake riot against one of the congressmen in Chicago or aldermen. And he was outside. I think he was waving a fake gun, which is something terribly irresponsible. And they just threw him in the car. And then he was later released. But I think he was saying, like, fight the power when he was getting thrown in the... And there is video footage of it somewhere. So it was always like... And filming, like, taking a character... from the show and then filming that person in the real world doing a prank. It was always, like, mm-hmm. sort of aggressive in that way. And then, trying to think of the highlights. Yeah, 98, we got our own show. Like, we went to Aspen Comedy Festival in 97. 98, we got our own show. And then also in 98, we opened our first theater. And when we got to New York, we literally, I remember just, like, saying, all right, I'm going to give it 3 months because I love Chicago. I'm born in Chicago. And that's kind of how we worked. We'd say, all right, we'll go 3 months, and then we'll... Because it was easy to, like, somebody says, you want to do this? And so to keep four people and four careers together, as you know,
yeah.
is very difficult, so you have to have that kind of short-term commitment. But fortunately, when we landed, we had, like, two shows that we've been doing in Chicago, and we opened a free improv show called The Ass Cat, and that's what really put us on the map, because nobody had seen long-form improvisation like we do in Chicago.
Right.
We were lucky enough to be, like, the first people who were good at it. And then we also met a contingency of... former Chicagoans like Adam McKay and Brian McCann and Brian Stack and Andy Richter, who would yeah. occasionally play with us, and Stephen Colbert,
yeah.
they would come in and play with us. So there was a real strong, you know, improv community there. So doing that improv show built us a real following, and because it was free, and then we started teaching classes because people were so interested in it. And that money back in the day, we would just pool it to pay for props, to make short movies, you know,
right,
community
right.
money, never put in our pocket. And that allowed us, that money from teaching classes allowed us to, you know, pay 3 months lease on a theater, which fortunately we were able to keep.
And this long form improv that you're talking about, that's the stuff that Del Close was teaching in Chicago. Is that right? I mean, it's not so much what Second City used to do, but it's more of what the I.O. used to do? Improv Olympic?
Yeah, Second City was more short-formy, or not short-formy, but much more quick hit. And they also would take suggestions and go back and write, generally, and then come back out with, like, premises that they were, you know, using and processing through. And then what Del was a big fan of was, like, the Herald he created, which is that three-act structure for repeating scenes. And then, yeah, so we were doing long-form, basically, from what we learned at Improv Olympic. And I also, me personally, I studied with people like McNapier, and so I had my own sort of annoyance. That was the theater that I came from, my own annoyance influence. But yeah, we were doing long form versus short form, and short form, as you know, is basically like, you know, doing a scene and then saying stop, and then giving us an emotion, and then continuing, or like, we're going to sing a song, now give us another style you'd like to see us sing that same song in. So they're very, like, specific rules that you're given before you attempt to do short form, where in long form you literally go off of one suggestion and then it can go anywhere.
Well, and one of the things that I always loved about the UCB when I would see you guys in Chicago, because by the time you went off to New York, I forget where we were. I guess I might have been moved out here, and I was always on tour with the RSC, so I don't think I ever saw you guys in New York. But when I saw you guys in Chicago, it was all, everything you did was so deadpan. It's so straight, so not letting the audience know that what they're watching is a comedy.
Yeah.
Or even supposed to be comic.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the premise for the shows were generally, like, the overriding premise is, like, we were a revolutionary group who was trying to undermine the status quo. That always, whatever the premise of the show or the sketches were, it was always, there was always this overriding structure. And I remember the name Upright Citizens Brigade coming from. We would do sketches, like, really aggressive sketches, and then at the end of it, we would say, thank you, we have been citizens for social justice, which is like making fun of how profound we'd been, when actually we weren't. And then somehow the name Upright Citizens Brigade stuck, and then we took that name, and that became like this invisible organization that ran the show. So all the shows were sort of like rebellious, like there was a bigger premise involved, even though there was a funny sketch. It was sort of subversive, and all the material seemed to be subversive, and I think that's what played into, you know, playing it real and deadpan. And I also think that's our training in Chicago with people like Del or a guy named Noah Gregoropoulos. Like, always play it real, you know, as believable as possible.
Right. Well, and it's led to this great career you have going, this film career you have going now of
huge. I'm taking money out of your baby's mouth.
You are. Yeah, you are. Because you're playing all the authority figures that I should be playing.
You're a better doctor and a better lawyer. There's no doubt.
I don't know. I don't think I could have been a better doctor than you were in The Hangover.
Okay.
And really, did you get hazard pay working with that old guy in his tighty whities?
That was really surprising. I didn't know I was going to see a naked man that morning. I think Todd talked him into doing that on the moment.
Really?
Yeah.
You found this extra and went, oh, I can use this.
Yeah.
But so talk a little bit about the school of the UCB, the Upright Citizens Brigade, because you have a theater in New York, a building, and a training program, and you've got one out here now in L.A. And really, people talk about UCB now the way they still talk about Second City and the Groundlings here in L.A., and the and I guess maybe I.O. as well, Improv Olympic as well. I mean, sort of those four things. UCB has arguably become bigger than all of those things. Why do you think that is? What the hell do you know?
I think what set us apart from the other schools that I've been in, like Second City or Improv Olympic, I never did Groundlings or even the Annoyances. We really created a curriculum as if it was a university of improv. We were very strict about what each level would teach, because sometimes, not naming names of the schools I would go in, like, it depended on the teacher. Like, if you had a good teacher, you'd learn something. And if you had a bad teacher, it was kind of like they would just say, great job, and you'd feel good about yourself, but you'd walk away thinking, I didn't get any tools. I don't really know how to repeat that.
Yeah.
And so we were really strict from the beginning of, like, this is, you know, the focus of what we're teaching. And our big sort of revolution, or our separation from what we came from, is we came up with this concept of the game. Like, every comedic scene, whether it be improv or sketch written, has to have some sort of game, and that's the dynamic that you're basically playing in the scene, and that you're heightening and exploring throughout. Right. So that was our big revolution, and then it was just lucky. Like, as you know, you started a business that turned into a, or you started a small thing that turned into a business for you.
Right.
It's the same thing. Like, we were teaching classes in New York to fund our little prop chest and such, or to pay airline tickets to come to LA.
Right.
And then we had enough students to get a theater, basically because we were tired of, you know, bringing our trunk to new theaters. And in New York, they were very snooty about, oh, you're from Chicago, this is New York, and they never really treated you well, and then you'd have to pack your shit out at the end of the night.
Right.
So it was kind of like, let's have our own clubhouse.
Yeah.
And then fortunately we already had five or six shows up before we had a theater, because the people we'd been teaching started doing sketch shows that we directed or we helped write. Right. And then so we had this little, you know, Bagamon community, and once we landed, those people were all interested in doing shows. And fortunate for them, because all those people have gone on, like Paul Scheer and Rob Riggle, they walked into a theater where we needed performers seven nights a week. So these guys who just discovered improv had stage time six nights a week to just start running. And so it was a great experience for everybody. And then you get people to run it. Like, obviously, I'm not a businessman. I don't know how yours runs, but the smart people are handling the money.
Right.
And then creatively, the four of us sort of weigh in on where we should be going or what's next through email and occasionally like an annual meeting.
I'm Adam Felber of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and author of Schrodinger's Ball, the novel, and you are listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company's podcast.
Tell me a little bit about how the UCB ethos, both creatively and, I guess, spiritually, translated itself into this TV show.
We met a guy named Kent Alterman, who was a Comedy Central exec, who fell in love with us. And so he was our, like, intermediary. Mm-hmm. He was an exec over there. And he fell in love with us and got us a show. And then, to Comedy Central's credit, they were small back then. They had just, when we broke, I think South Park had just made a big splash. So they were dealing with South Park and merchandising Cartman dolls. And there was a lot of money coming in from them. So the other things kind of fell by the wayside. So we never really got any censor notes. And I don't believe in our first season they had a censorship department. I remember one email that was really funny, where we could say ball sack, the word ball sack, like twice, but we couldn't say it seven times. Like, there were silly, and I wish I still had the faxes, but there were those things going on, but very rarely, like season one, two, and three. And I think one scene, Amy Poehler put a shotgun in her mouth and shot herself, and they said, you can't, even though it happened off screen, you heard the shot off screen, you can't imply that she died. So then we had to loop in a line saying, I'm okay. Like, after you see her put a gun in her mouth, then off camera you hear a blast, and then you hear a little girl go, I'm okay. That was completely complying with their request. But other than that, they were really cool because of Kent, and because I think the popularity of some of the other shows,
right,
we were a little fish. And so, yeah, and it was easy. Also, the first season was easy because we'd done so many shows, like several in Chicago, and we'd done like three or four in New York by the time we had a show on TV, so we could call all these sketches and bring them together. And then we also had the Ask Cat show, which is our free improv show, and we would tape those. And then every night, you know, we'd look at the tapes, and if there's something interesting, somebody would say, I'd like to write that up. Because you come up with good ideas, never... Sometimes you could literally transcribe a scene if it was really well done, and you could take that improv scene and turn it into a sketch verbatim.
Wow. Well, and it's, and that's a lot of work too. Yeah. Not only to do the scenes, but then to go look at the material and wade through.
Well, you can fast forward through most of it, to be honest. You'll remember the good stuff.
So the TV show wasn't improvised. It had to be scripted.
Yeah.
Did you have to submit scripts ahead of time?
Yeah, we had like we would develop the shows, we would take sketches and then kind of place them thematically, so then themes would appear. So this would be the restaurant episode, this would be the mafia episode. And then once the themes started appearing, we tried to apply the thread of what the Herald is, where you have a first beat of a scene and then you revisit, so it's not just a sketch that dies, but you come back to a second beat and hopefully you can heighten it. And then by the third beats of all these sketches, they would come together in surprising ways, much like Pulp Fiction developed. You had like several storylines seemingly disconnected and all of a sudden they're intertwined. That's how we approached the sketch show. That was our sort of take on it to make it more interesting.
Cool. And is there any hope that the four of you will get back together for some film or TV project, given all of your schedules, you, Besser, Ian, Amy?
No near future plan. The big thing we're working on is this, which is so boring. We're writing a book about comedy, which is like the dumbest endeavor to take on. It's just so drudge. It's such drudgery.
Yeah, well, writing about it, talk about taking the fun out of comedy.
Yeah. It's literally like a college-level textbook about how to become a better improviser and basically teaching people why comedy works, in our opinion. You know, it's not It's not arrogant. It's just like, this is what we've learned, but it's so...
No, those are opinions. It sounds like fact. Yeah, this is the only way to be a better improviser.
Well, and when you write a textbook, it's the hardest thing in the world because you're creating rules, and then the next chapter you violate that rule, and it's like, fuck. Now we got to go back and rewrite chapter one. And that's literally what we spend our day doing. Like, yeah, you can't do that. Oh, here's an exception.
Wait, didn't I just say we can do this? Yeah. Wait a second. You got to go back and look at your own rules.
Yeah. It'll be useful, but it's just...
Like anything else, I mean, it'll be like, all right, here's the textbook, and then people will read it and go, this is great, and here's how I'm going to deviate from that. Here are the rules. You got to know the rules to break the rules.
Yeah, and it'll be good for like a common reference point in the school. Yeah. Like you can refer to the what's the definition of this term that gets bandied about all the time, and then it'll keep people kind of centrally located on the meaning of these terms. And then, of course, it's just experience, like you said, and hopefully people will come on to their own take, and it'll flourish in a better way. Sure.
It's got to be awesome that you, the four of you, can agree on these things.
Yeah, it has to be an agreement. You're right. It's.
I mean, agreement is the way that improv works, but writing a book is kind of different.
Well, it's not opinion because generally the best idea does win out.
Yeah.
It truly does. It's not like my sketch is funnier. It's not subjective material. It's like no. Here's my point, and here's my argument for why, or here's an exception to what you're saying.
Yeah.
And then if everybody keeps their ego out of it, it tends to work.
Yeah. But on top of all that, you're busy with your other megalomania things. You're writing, directing movies? What is this? Tell me about this.
I directed and wrote a movie this summer called The High Road. I wrote it with a guy, Josh Weiner, and it was a completely improvised movie. And so we had a screenplay, as many of us do, that nobody wanted to make and give us money for.
I have a couple of those, I think.
Great. I wish I would have been talking to you. And so we recycled the story from that. We pulled all the story points out, plotted out the story into like 65 scenes, and each scene had a little paragraph underneath which explained what needs to happen and what characters need to be there. And then we shot that improvisationally. And then we had joke sheets on the day from the script or things we thought of, like given... a situation, if they're in a restaurant, like here's a funny order,
right?
Here's five funny things you could say to a waitress.
Am I right remembering you contributed jokes to or scenarios to Borat?
Yeah.
What was
Bruno.
That? To Bruno, okay.
I worked on the Bruno movie as a consultant for like a year and a half, and I would just write jokes and scenarios because of my experience in improv, and I worked on the show Dog Bites Man, which was very similar to what Sasha does.
And that's a situation where you're coming up with what would happen if Bruno met Ron Paul in a hotel room or whatever.
No, he tells you, like, he'll say, I'm going to meet a drill instructor or I'm going to meet the head of the Klan or I'm going to meet Ron Paul. Then you can write me 50 questions or 50 activities I can do with this man.
Okay.
So that's basically my job. I didn't really create story because when I came in, they had a script and they kind of knew where it was going. It was always fluctuating.
Yeah. What did that teach you about comedy or even filmmaking?
Being prepared pays off, and that, because Sasha really isn't an improviser. He's a very well-prepared actor. Like, he goes in there knowing what he wants to get out of there, and he's also very fearless. Like, obviously, he's incredibly fearless.
Yeah.
Like,
never drops character, they say.
No. Yeah. No, not afraid to do anything. And you also learn that, like, when you're pranking people, you'd be surprised with what you can get away with. Like, you write something that's like, there's no way they're going to not think this is fake. And they do. They totally buy it.
Would you consider the UCB a cult or mainstream?
It's a benevolent cult, is what I jokingly say. But I think it's becoming more mainstream because...
Yeah. Because of all your students, I think.
Because of all our students. And ultimately, at the end of the day, what we're known for most is that it's a comedy theater where really funny people... Who necessarily haven't trained with us even. You know, just you can go see a funny show in New York. We're going to have a second theater in New York opening in January.
Wow.
In the Lower East Side. And but yeah, we're known as a comedy theater. And then we have a website like UCBtheater.com where people do videos. So we're basically known as a comedy thing. So I think we're becoming more mainstream. But I think for a long time we were this little like subculture that people in the know knew about, but generally America didn't know about. We're sort of... reach the tipping point where it's like we have brand recognition and all that, and so yeah, I guess we're more mainstream in a way.
All those great corporate synergistic words.
Yeah.
Brand recognition.
Which my mother tends to hate everything we do, by the way. So I don't know if we're for everyone, but
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your comedy textbook via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on our website podcast page, and you can post reviews on our podcast page on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website, reducedshakespeare.com, and our Reduced Shakespeare Company fan page at facebook.com. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, ReducedShakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, Doctor of Comedy Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Victor Hill. No reason, it's just random. Thanks to Adam Felber from NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 210 630ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. And you'll be happy to know that here on the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, you can say whatever you'd like to say.
Balzac, 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 Balzac. Balzac. I was saying Balzac, the author.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.